8-2 Anselmo versus State. This is the time set for oral argument regarding this matter. We all tried to be flexible in how this got scheduled. There were some issues kind of on all sides, including the snow that we got here in Carson and Reno yesterday, and apparently more maybe tonight. So we decided to be flexible in allowing counsel to make those decisions for themselves under the circumstances in combination with COVID and other illness issues. So thank you for being here today with all of that going on. So we have counsel for appellant present in the Las Vegas courtroom, and for respondent we have by video. We do have the clock showing up on the screen because we have the official clock here in the courtroom in Carson, and where Justice Herndon and I are present, and Justice Pickering is present in the Las Vegas courtroom. So this is set for a 30-minute argument with each side having 15 minutes. So counsel, I guess before you get started, let me know if you would like to reserve any time. Oh, I'm not hearing you. Hang on. Okay.
Are we good? Can you hear me?
Yes.
I would like to reserve 4 minutes of my argument for rebuttal.
Okay. And so what happens is you're still going to be starting at the full 15 minutes, and it counts down from there. But when it gets to 4 minutes, the yellow light comes on, and there's a tone to signal you that you're now into what you want to be your rebuttal time. So, but it's up to you to stop talking and say you reserve the rest of the time. Otherwise, the clock keeps going. You understand how that works?
I understand.
Okay. All right. With that, then, you may begin.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Sydney Gambian, and I represent appellant Michael Anselmo. This appeal presents an issue of critical importance because it goes to the very integrity of our criminal justice system. At stake in this appeal is a criminal defendant's ability to demonstrate his actual innocence of the crime for which he was convicted due to the availability of DNA testing of the evidence. In 1972, petitioner Michael Anselmo was convicted of murdering Trudy Hyler and sentenced to life in prison. In 2018, Mr. Anselmo, with the help of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, filed a petition for genetic testing of some physical evidence from his trial approximately 45 years ago. It may be 48 now, I'm not sure, which remarkably remains in the custody of the state. Importantly, the identity of the perpetrator in this crime was at issue at trial, meaning that Mr. Anselmo's defense was not that of, say, consent or self-defense. And at trial, the physical evidence linking Mr. Anselmo to the crime was scant and has never been subjected to DNA testing. That evidence includes Ms. Hyler's purse and pantyhose, fingernail clippings from Ms. Hyler, two blonde hair strands found in Ms. Hyler's car, and a rape kit from Ms. Hyler. The statutory scheme for DNA testing in Nevada is multi-tiered, and a petitioner must pass each step to proceed to the next. These steps are, one, the petitioner files a petition meeting procedural requirements. Two, the district court ascertains whether the physical evidence exists and in whose custody it remains. Three, the district court determines whether the petition meets the standard for DNA testing. Four, the evidence is tested and determined whether to be favorable to the petitioner or not. Five, if the results are favorable, the petitioner may make a motion for new trial. And six, if the petitioner is successful in the motion for new trial, the petitioner is either retried with the benefit of the DNA evidence, or the state can decline to retry the petitioner. Here, the district court granted Mr. Anselmo's petition in part, determining the petition met procedural requirements. But the district court erred in two ways when it ultimately denied the petition, at the second and third steps of the statutory scheme. I will discuss these two steps out of order, with the third step first, as that is the primary issue on this appeal. First, although the district court correctly recited the language of the statute in NRS 176.09183, it actually applied a much more stringent standard. Recent case law from this court clarifies the standard and makes clear that the district court misapplied it. Second, Mr. Anselmo is entitled to an adequate evidence inventory, and the district court failed to require sufficient compliance from the state. As to the first and primary issue on this appeal, NRS 176.0918 sub 3 sub B requires that the petitioner seeking DNA testing demonstrate only that a reasonable possibility exists that the petitioner would not have been prosecuted or convicted if exculpatory results had been obtained through DNA testing. As an initial matter, the statute inherently requires the district court to assume the evidence would be exculpatory. The state argues that such evidence would not be exculpatory because of overwhelming evidence of guilt at trial and because it is far more likely that any genetic profile generated will point to Mr. Anselmo, but this is exactly the type of argument the legislature does not allow. Turning to the standard for testing, Nevada uses the reasonable possibility standard, but the vast majority of states use a reasonable probability, which undoubtedly requires more than a reasonable possibility. A reasonable possibility only requires that there be a real possibility that the evidence would have affected the result. This court acknowledged in James v. State this year that reasonable possibility is a lesser standard than reasonable probability. In James, the court acknowledged that when the results of this analysis would be irrelevant to the state's theory of the crime or the defendant's defense, a reasonable possibility does not exist. In James, the district court erred in denying a DNA petition where the identity of the perpetrator was at issue and exculpatory DNA evidence would have undermined the state's version of events and supported the defense. The same is true here, where Mr. Anselmo denied that he murdered Ms. Heiler, and DNA evidence would have supported Mr. Anselmo's defense that someone else murdered Ms. Heiler. The district court misapplied this standard, denying the petition because it found compelling that the jury already heard other exculpatory evidence in the case on the same topics, and convicted Mr. Anselmo anyway. First, the district court's analysis confuses the standard. Nowhere in the statutory scheme is the district court permitted to consider other exculpatory evidence and whether the jury convicted anyway. This is the wrong inquiry. The question the district court should have considered is whether exculpatory DNA evidence could have a reasonable possibility of influencing the prosecution or conviction of the petitioner. And the district court failed to consider at all whether the DNA evidence could have affected the prosecution of Mr. Anselmo. For instance, had the rape kit been tested and matched another individual, this very well could have changed the entire course of the investigation into the murder of Ms. Heiler. The investigating officers and prosecution could very well have identified and investigated another suspect and never prosecuted Mr. Anselmo at all. Second, had the district court actually considered whether exculpatory DNA evidence would have changed the result, the district court would have had to acknowledge the power of DNA evidence to influence a jury. DNA evidence is unlike any other physical evidence. Unlike matching hair color or the quantity of sperm in a sample, DNA evidence can conclusively exclude a person as the source of that DNA in hairs or a semen sample. What's more, DNA testing could have conclusively identified another individual at the scene of the crime or as Ms. Heiler's sexual assailant. The district court ignored DNA evidence altogether and essentially determined the evidence at trial was sufficient to support conviction. For example, the district court found significant Mr. Anselmo's reliance on Dr. Lobster's testimony. But the district court focused only on the fact that Mr. Anselmo's semen sample contained sperm and the seminal fluid sample did not. Dr. Lobster offered two competing explanations for this. One, that the sperm had degenerated, or two, that the donor was sterile. The district court acknowledged that the jury heard the two explanations, the second being exculpatory, and could still conclude that Mr. Anselmo was the source of the seminal fluid because of the degenerative nature of sperm. At no time did the district court consider or analyze the impact of DNA evidence that excludes Mr. Anselmo as the source of that seminal fluid sample. Had DNA evidence excluded Mr. Anselmo, the jury could not have reasonably concluded that Mr. Anselmo was the source of that sample. The district court also devalued this evidence, finding persuasive the state's argument that the prosecution at trial was primarily focused on premeditated murder and not felony murder. But this is not supported by the record. The jury simply convicted Mr. Anselmo of first-degree murder, saying nothing of which theory was ultimately successful. Therefore, if the jury believed, as the prosecution argued, that whoever sexually assaulted Ms. Heiler also murdered her, DNA evidence would have made a difference. The state now claims that this was not a rape case. But the prosecution at trial argued the exact opposite, saying everything cries out to show this was a rape case. Prosecution went so far as to argue that, quote, There is only one time, one reasonable time, that all of the evidence would indicate she would have sexual intercourse, and that was right before the murder, right before she was killed. The fact that her body was found nude and the circumstance indicate that she was murdered in the perpetration of rape, and that is so obvious, the facts scream out to tell you that. If the facts are so obvious that whoever raped Ms. Hyler also murdered her, the presence of another person's DNA in that seminal fluid sample would have resulted in a prosecution of that individual, not Mr. Onsamo. The same is true of other DNA evidence, which includes Ms. Hyler's purse, containing the victim's clothes as she was found wearing none, pantyhose or nylons, her fingernail clippings, which could have contained DNA evidence of Ms. Hyler's killer, not only in blood, but in skin cells, especially given that Ms. Hyler had over 100 bruises on her limbs and was strangled and very likely touched her attacker during the crime. The hairs found in the car, where there were obvious signs of a struggle, including a bent steering wheel and a damaged drive shaft. Had the other physical evidence been tested and excluded Mr. Onsamo as the source of any DNA, this would be highly probative to the defense's theory that Mr. Onsamo was not the person who strangled Ms. Hyler or declothed her. And if all or some of the evidence matched some other person, this would surely undermine the confidence in the outcome of trial or could have completely changed the outcome of or the course of the investigation. The district court's task is to determine whether all of the evidence, the state's evidence and the defense evidence, plus the addition of exculpatory DNA evidence, presents a reasonable possibility that the petitioner would not have been convicted or prosecuted, and the district court here failed to go through this exercise.
May I interrupt
just
you
for a second?
Counsel? Hi, this is
yes.
Judge Herndon in Carson City. I have a question about 176-09-183. And Ms. Kate, you can address this when it's your opportunity to speak as well. But in a murder case such as this, when the statute refers to would not have been prosecuted or convicted, it doesn't really account for the fact that if you take felony murder out of it and it's a first-degree murder charge, there are first-degree murder, second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, and involuntary manslaughter options for that. So how do you propose the court should interpret that statute, meaning is it just convicted, period, or convicted of the crime charged, and why?
Are you talking about whether there were lesser included charges? Is that what you're referring to?
No. I mean, look, we can look at this case and say if there's not a felony murder allegation and it's just charged as premeditated and deliberate murder, the jury's going to be instructed on second degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, potentially involuntary manslaughter as well. So when the statute speaking to post-conviction DNA analysis says, is there a reasonable possibility that the gentleman would not have been prosecuted or convicted, is it speaking to convicted of anything or just convicted of what he was charged with, meaning first-degree murder?
I believe it would have to be whether he was convicted of anything, Your Honor, because the DNA evidence could have completely changed the outcome of that trial, and the penalties for those are different. The scheme is only available to a petitioner who is sentenced to, I believe it's life in prison, and that changed in 2009. It used to be only capital crimes, only a death sentence. Even if the petitioner could theoretically be convicted of something else at trial, I think that's getting really into the weeds for the threshold inquiry about whether the evidence should be tested, and that's really more a question of motion for a new trial, which we are not at that step here today. That is step five in the statute.
So are you saying that at this stage, Ms. Gamby, that at this stage the question is whether he would have been prosecuted or convicted of the crime he actually was prosecuted and convicted of?
Right. I don't think that you can say, oh, well, he would have been convicted of second degree or manslaughter or something else, so we might as well not go through this inquiry. I don't think that was the intent of the statute, though it is silent as to whether it is the crime for which he was actually convicted or any other lesser charges that were raised at trial.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. You're down to 3 minutes. Do you want to reserve the rest?
I'll just get through my second argument real quickly, and then I'll reserve.
Okay. It's up to you.
The second issue pertains to the evidence inventory compiled by the state. Mr. Onsamo made a motion to get a more sufficient inventory from the state before the district court because the state presented an inventory that included descriptions of the evidence containers, not the actual evidence. The state is wrong that this court has no jurisdiction over this issue. Nothing in the statute limits the appealability of the denial of a motion prior to the dismissal of the petition. And in any event, even if the court reverses the district court's denial of petition, judicial economy requires that the state be required to comply with the statutory requirement now and name the evidence to be in its possession, not the containers, because without this, the parties will surely be before this court again should the evidence tested not actually match the evidence named in the petition. For these reasons, Mr. Anselmo respectfully requests that the court reverse the district court's rulings with respect to both the petition and the evidence inventory motion and instruct the district court to require the state to compile an inventory of the evidence and require testing of that evidence. And with that, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Kate.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me before I get started?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, good afternoon. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Marilee Kate, and I represent the state of Nevada in this case. This court should affirm the district court's decision because here the district court's decision is based on the trial record, and Anselmo has not shown that the district court's decision is clearly wrong, which is what James instructed us that the analysis or the standard of review is of factual findings. In addition, judicial estoppel supports the district court's decision. And then finally, the state's position is that the district court properly denied Anselmo's motion for order to show cause because nothing in the statutory scheme contemplates pre-petition discovery. And Anselmo hasn't provided any authority to suggest, either from Nevada or elsewhere, to suggest that that items of evidence that are completely sealed, have a chain of custody, should be opened just because a petition is filed.
Well, Ms. Kate, sorry, Justice Kadish in Carson City, let me stop you there. NRS 176.0918(4), which is the basis for that inventory requirement, talks about that the court, if the court schedules a hearing, that the court shall immediately issue an order requiring each person or agency in possession or custody to prepare an inventory of all evidence relevant to the claims in the petition within the possession or custody of the person or agency. So I guess my question is, doesn't that language suggest that that agency should look at what is this petition actually asking about possibly testing and prepare an inventory of items potentially that could be so tested rather than just, here, this is what we got?
Sure. Thank you for the question, Justice Kadish. I understand that what the statute requires, but the Washoe County Sheriff's Office and the court evidence custodian did provide a list of what they had and described it to the best of their ability. And what I would note is the cases relied on by Anselmo to suggest that the evidence custodian should do further inquiry, break the seals, the chains of custody in these cases on every item of evidence is actually not supported by the case law that's provided by Anselmo's counsel. In fact, in the Chenix case, which is a federal case, I believe from the Eastern District of Virginia, there the court didn't order further inquiry into the actual items and evidence until after the court had determined that the petition should be granted. So the court said, okay, I'm going to assume that these items are here. We're going to do further inquiry to figure out what items should truly be tested. But they had made that initial decision that the petition should be granted. And there, the court actually contemplated that, you know, you could do further discovery specifically with police reports to try to match up what items should actually be tested. But there was no contemplation of opening every item.
Sorry, how can the court frame an order and tell them what should be tested if they don't get an inventory that actually lists what items are available to be tested?
Well, I think that's what happened in that Chenix case is the court said, I want testing, and then the agencies and the parties came back and said, okay, we're not sure if this item would be subject to testing. And then further discovery was done at that point when it was determined testing was appropriate. But what the statute doesn't contemplate is in every case where a petition's filed that we open every item of evidence just so a petitioner can identify items that he potentially wants tested. That's that actually is kind of putting the cart before the horse. The petitioner is supposed to identify what he reasonably believes is in the possession of the state. And then the analysis later is whether petition, if he's right, whether we should do testing, and then ordering testing. And so here, I think what Anselmo did is they asked for this discovery because they wanted to pursue additional claims, not because they needed the discovery to assist them or because the court needed the discovery to assist it in ordering testing because the court determined testing wasn't appropriate.
The statutory scheme itself provides for this requirement to prepare the inventory. It's not like they just, you know, sent some random discovery request here.
Right. Okay. Well, so and another thing that I'd note, too, another case relied on by Anselmo is State v. DeMarco, and they relied on it. It's a New Jersey case, and their standard is quite different, but Anselmo relied on it to support his analysis that he demonstrated a reasonable possibility existed. But also in the discussion of that case, the court noted that there was the prosecutor and the inventories had various items of sealed evidence, and then the court and counsel were going to go through, once the court determined testing was appropriate, and determine what items should actually be opened. And so I think none of the authority provided by Anselmo suggests that a court should simply just order that every item of evidence in the possession of the state be opened so that a petitioner can develop further claims of items they want testing.
So if we find there is a reasonable possibility, should the court order open the canister and test it if there's something there that's testable? Is that how the order should get framed?
Well, I think the court, it wouldn't be as broad. I think even in the Chenix case, the court found that the petitioner was asking for more discovery than was appropriate. Certainly, I think we could look and determine if we believe the items that petitioner is asking for testing on may exist in these sealed containers. And we can match those potentially by police reports, by other information we have, as opposed to opening the items now, just assuming that there might be something in there. And so I think the court and counsel, and that's what's contemplated in some of these other opinions, is can actually do that inquiry, can call a witness from the crime lab or call the evidence custodian and address that issue if testing is appropriate. And so I do want to address a couple things specific about the reasonable possibility standard and this case, because obviously that is a significant issue. And I think it's helpful that the James opinion came out, and Ms. Gamby and I obviously have very different interpretations of what that opinion means to this case. And I would note that if we are going to look at kind of historically what the Nevada Supreme Court, what the Court of Appeals has done in these cases, what's unique to me and what struck me as I was reviewing some of these unpublished opinions and the James case is in the cases where testing was ordered, the defendant maintained his innocence. And in the cases where testing was denied or this court affirmed the denial of testing were cases where there was a confession, where the other circumstantial evidence supported the verdict. And so, you know, specifically in James, I think this kind of bears out really what our dispute is exculpatory evidence is specific, it's fact specific to the case. And so in James, the reason that the evidence was exculpatory is because it was a sexual assault case. The victim had said that she didn't have sexual intercourse for a year prior to her assault, and the defendant maintained his innocence, and not related to his petition, but there was presumptive DNA testing done that he learned of after his conviction that pointed to another individual. So he had all those things together, brought it to the district court. The district court denied it without making findings, but I think that in that scenario, and this court noted, you know, he maintained his innocence, what the victim had said about her prior sexual contact as being important to why that result would be exculpatory and why there would be a reasonable possibility that that defendant wouldn't have been prosecuted or convicted. Whereas here, what, and I believe Ms. Gamby said, is if the exculpatory evidence would be that it wouldn't be Anselmo. But the problem that I have with that analysis is that's not necessarily exculpatory under the facts of this case. The fact that the rape kit, or I'm using, you know, rape because there is kind of a dispute about whether what that was, but the fact that Anselmo's DNA wouldn't be found in the rape kit wouldn't make a difference to this case. And in fact, Anselmo's counsel during closing argument argued that Miss Hyler could have had sexual relations, you know, within the 24 hours before her death, and it wasn't Anselmo. And that's how, when Miss Gamby quoted the prosecutor,
let me interrupt you for a moment, if I might. Doesn't the statute mandate that the court must consider the evidence to be exculpatory when they engage in the reasonable possibility analysis?
So I think that I think that's my position, is even if we do assume that it's exculpatory, what Ms. Gamby's saying is exculpatory in this case means that it was Anselmo's DNA identified. But the state's position is that still doesn't mean that there's a reasonable possibility that he wouldn't have been prosecuted or convicted. And that's because it's somewhat irrelevant whose DNA was in the quote-unquote rape kit, because even his counsel at trial said, you know, she could have had sexual relations with someone else before
her murder.
It wasn't a murder case.
But
Sorry,
it's okay. It's hard over the video. There's a little delay. But it's one thing to have counsel argue that, but if there was, his whole theory at trial was that he came upon the scene after, if there was a rape that had happened, and after the murder had happened. And he said it was this other guy, right? Well, what if the DNA comes back and, in fact, it's John Suarez's DNA in there? Wouldn't that create a reasonable possibility he wouldn't have been convicted?
Well, I think under the facts of this case, that is a very large stretch given what was presented during the state's rebuttal. And even Anselmo's statement about John Suarez.
Well, it's possible Mr. Suarez lied on the stand. It happens.
No, actually, he didn't. I would completely disagree.
I'm not saying he did lie. I'm saying it's possible.
Well, but I think you have to look at the other facts presented, because Anselmo even got himself caught up during his testimony. He said, I saw John Soares on Tuesday during the day in Reno, and then I ended up seeing him again coming out of these bushes in this very fanciful theory. But in fact, the state presented rebuttal evidence, not from just John Soares, but from the car salesman that said, actually, on the Tuesday, John Soares was finishing purchasing his vehicle.
Right.
In LA.
DNA is on her rape kit, wouldn't that be stronger evidence than just credibility challenge between witnesses?
But I think we're making a very speculative argument that isn't consistent with the actual evidence that's been presented in this case. And when the legislators instituted this bill, the idea was that the district court was supposed to look at it consistent with the facts in the case and determine whether it was appropriate based on the facts in the case. And here, John Soares' idea was, I would submit, and the jury must have agreed, disproven.
Let me interrupt you again, Ms. Kate, and I apologize. I know we have a lot of questions, and it's kind of difficult when we keep interrupting you. But this case, the allegation is that there were a number of things that were sought to be tested that is known about, including the vaginal swabs, which contained sperm fractions, apparently. The idea that there may be fingernail clippings, clothing from the victim, the purse of the victim, some hair found in the victim's car. Let's assume for purposes of this question that all of those things come back with DNA, particularly the advent of touch DNA where we are today, and they're all the same person. Do you really think there is not a reasonable juror that might have found that to be compelling evidence that this gentleman didn't commit the crimes?
I don't think under these facts in this case, because the jury was already presented with exculpatory evidence about the hairs, that it wasn't Anselmo. I mean, that was that his fingerprints weren't found in the car, that his sample contained semen as opposed to what was found in Ms. Hyler. And so that exculpatory evidence on those points, if you want to call it exculpatory evidence, was presented. The thing here is, even if a third party was identified, I think this court recognized in an unpublished decision, but in the LaPena case, that really the fact that third party's DNA is found on some of these items only means that the third party touched that item at some point in time.
Sure.
And here we have Ms. Hyler living with multiple people, multiple women. The hair strands were bleached and, you know, 4 to 9 inches long, so suggestive that it's roommates. But living with multiple people, and Anselmo's statements themselves with respect to the pantyhose, he said that he, you know, bunched clothing and choked Ms. Hyler, not that he, you know, hung her with her pantyhose or something like that. So I think when you actually get down into the details of the facts that were presented in this case, even if we assume a third party's DNA was found, it doesn't necessarily mean that Anselmo wasn't the murderer. And the other circumstantial evidence, his testimony that was contradicted multiple times, his admissions to lying and creating stories about sores, and Ms. Hyler, all those things combined, which is the district court noted in its order. May I just conclude?
Yes.
Thank you. All those things were noted by the district court in its order, in its analysis, that really that reasonable possibility wouldn't have existed in this case with these specific facts. Thank you. I just ask that the court affirm the district court's decision denying genetic marker testing.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Gamby, you have a minute 55.
Thank you. DNA is the best evidence in this case. The state says Anselmo's theory of defense was a stretch, but it must be assumed that the DNA evidence would be exculpatory. At trial, as your honors have touched on, there was competing witness testimony, but DNA evidence is different in that it excludes or identifies people to a certain degree of scientific certainty. It's not just the jury that may have been impacted by this DNA evidence. It's the officers who were investigating the crime. Had the officers had the benefit of this DNA evidence, had this DNA evidence all matched someone else, one other person, or even had some of it matched another person, that would have presented a new lead for those officers to investigate, could have potentially led to a different suspect, and it could have potentially led to Mr. Anselmo never being prosecuted at all. That is a very real possibility where you have here a rape kit and other physical evidence that the killer would have had to touch to declothe Ms. Hyler after killing her. The standard is not just whether Mr. Anselmo would have been convicted. It is whether he would have been prosecuted or convicted. And either way, the DNA evidence would have made a difference here. I'll touch very briefly on the standard on review. The standard is not whether the district court was clearly wrong. The standard is a mixed one, apparently from James. De novo for issues of law and abuse of discretion for issues of fact. And typically mixed issues of law and fact are de novo as well. The district court did not apply the standard. The district court did not make findings of fact as to exculpatory DNA evidence. And in this respect, this is a mixed question of law and fact that should be reviewed de novo by this court. And very quickly on the evidence inventory, Mr. Anselmo should not be prejudiced by the state's failure to initially label those pieces of evidence by what the evidence was rather than the containers containing them. And for those reasons, we request that this district court be reversed.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate the briefing and the argument on this case. And we will take it under advisement. And at this point, we will be in recess. Thanks so much.